2 weeks ago, Robin led worship here in the Quaker tradition, a style of worship which, for the most part, the congregation sits in meditative silence the entire hour. For some, silent worship is deeply spiritual, and for others, it has little, if any, meaning. We know millions of people throughout the centuries and throughout the world make pilgrimages to sacred shrines, and millions of others wonder why, considering religious pilgrimages little more than the equivalent of superstition. Some people have lifelong devotional practices, while others feel a walk in the woods is about as religious as they want to get. That people have different spiritual tastes and different spiritual needs is self-evident. Several years ago, my husband's niece, a very devout Catholic, petitioned the church for permission to have her wedding ceremony conducted in a full-length mass in Latin. Karen, I wasn't invited. But I know that church where her wedding took place. The sanctuary is filled with statuary and crucifixes and flickering votives, and it's always dark. And whenever I'm in a church like that, I feel almost suffocated and so closed in that all I can think about is getting outside in fresh air and natural light. An ornate church, for me, is not at all conducive to feeling spiritual. And yet that I know for many, maybe most people, a church adorned with statuary invites deeply worshipful feelings. As UUs, we pride ourselves on diversity, and perhaps for us especially, this question of spiritual differences is truly intriguing. This morning's sermon is based in large part, on this book called Four Spiritualities by UU minister Reverend Peter Richardson. And in it, he describes four paths, explaining the unique features of each. And as I take you through these four paths, based on the four directions, north, south, east, and west, you will likely find yourself identifying with or having a greater affinity for one path or direction more than the others. We might think of these paths as spiritual flavors, like just about everything else in life, balance matters in spirituality too. And even though we might lay claim to one of the paths as ours, it's important to be open to the others as well. A Christian mystic once wrote, "It's helpful to think of the paths as a table. Each leg needs to be strong enough to keep the table even and upright." So here are the four paths. One, the path of unity. Now, on a circle, this path is found in the northern position at the top of the circle. It's also called the path of the intellect, and in spiritual terms, it's considered the path that envisions and seeks unity. The second path, at the opposite pole of the circle in the southern position, is the path of devotion. This is a path my niece would be most naturally drawn to, and it's just the opposite of where I'm comfortable. The path of devotion is also called the path of love and service, and in spiritual terms, it is best described as the path that celebrates. Number three, in the eastern position, is the path of harmony, also called the path of meditation, and its spiritual work is to inspire. And number four, the final path in the western position on the circle, is the path of works, which, just as its name implies, is a path of deeds, and in spiritual terms, those on this path would fit into the spiritual category of institutionalists. Every faith, as well as every church and temple and mosque, has members that fall into all four of these categories. And while every categorization runs the risk of oversimplification and limiting options, I find these four spiritual categories truly useful in helping me understand how it is that people express their spiritualities in ways that are so very different from one another. Just as in all other faiths, Unitarian Universalists fall into every category or direction, but it's my sense that many of us would probably find ourselves on the path of unity in the northern position, because people on this path like to exchange ideas. They seek intellectual clarity, they analyze what's wrong with the world, and they want justice. They look for organizing principles, trust deeply in education for answers, believe in reform, and as Peter says, can become so overzealous in their commitment to long-range change that may at times neglect the immediate need right in front of them. People on the path of unity tend to be intuitive thinkers and are a significant minority in the general population, representing about only 12% of the people. However, they dominate comparative religious departments of colleges and universities. It explains why so many of us do not find the joke about Unitarians preferring a discussion group about heaven to heaven itself. What's funny about it? Who wants to be floating around with all those do-gooder angels when you could be having a lively, interesting, stimulating discussion? The most well-known religious exemplar that Peter cites for this path is the Buddha, because of his search for the great unifying truths of life. And there are a number of famous UUs on this path as well, including Theodore Parker, who always advocated justice over charity. Other Unitarians include Margaret Fuller, Joseph Priestley, Albert Schweitzer, and William Ellery Channing. Channing, considered the founder of the faith, had this to say about his understanding of God. This was in the early 1800s. The unbounded spirit, which we call God, is conceived by us only through consciousness, through the knowledge of ourselves. God is another name for human intelligence extended to all possible truth. Those on this path look for truths. Albert Schweitzer was seeking an idea that could bring together a worldview and an ethic in one unifying principle. You can hear this yearning by Schweitzer for a unifying principle in the excerpt that Tori will now read.
Lost in thought, I sat on the deck of the barge, struggling to find the elementary and universal conception of the ethical, which I had not discovered in any philosophy. Late on the third day, at the very moment when, at sunset, we were making our way through a herd of hippopotamuses, there flashed upon my mind, unforeseen and unsought, the phrase, reverence for life. The iron door had yielded, the path and the thicket had become visible. Now I had found my way to the idea in which affirmation of the world and ethics are contained side by side. Now I knew that the ethical acceptance of the world and of life, together with the ideals of civilization contained in this concept, had found foundation in thought.
So, classic path of unity thinking, knowledge, thought, truth. Moving clockwise around the circle, the next path is the path of harmony in the east. It is warmer than the path of unity, and it's also a minority spirituality. Again, only about 12% of the general population identifies with this path, and again, many are likely to be UUs. Those on this path are the idealists of the world, the peacekeepers, the visionaries, the dreamers. The religious impulse for the path of harmony is found in symbols and poetry and metaphor. Spiritual quests are important to those on the path of harmony. It's a very accepting spirituality, and it's adaptable, and people tend to be open to new forms and styles of worship. They are also eager to include traditions from other faiths. The path of harmony is grounded in mysticism, dreams, community, and meaning-making. Not surprisingly, its most famous Unitarian is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And scientist Lauren Isley, for whom science was a lifelong personal quest, also symbolizes this path. Jesus is the religious exemplar for the path of harmony. Listen to the Beatitudes and how they sound so much more like a social program for what life would be in the spiritual kingdom of God than they do ethical guidelines for how people should live here and now.
Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Moving across the circle, again to the opposite pole from the path of harmony, is the path of works, located in the western quadrant. Martin Luther is an example. His 16th century catechism is a basis for the old Protestant work ethic that sounds so familiar in Puritan New England. The path is characterized by bold faith, a dependable steadfastness, and by upright living. Peter says that if you are in the spiritual West, you appreciate that prayer is recited just as it was in your grandfather's day. Those who are on this spiritual path are not the dreamers and the visionaries, but the realists who see work as a means of meeting responsibilities. People in this quadrant tend to be accurate, objective, attentive to detail, analytical, prudent, and they have a strong sense of duty. Ministers, of course, like everyone in their congregation. However, they really like people on this path because people on this path volunteer for the jobs that keep the church going. They make up about 38% of the general population. The most famous Unitarian on this path was Reverend Henry Whitney Bellows, who even 100 years after his death is still affectionately known as the institutionalist. And thank heavens for him. Had it not been for him, we'd be even less organized on an associational level than we are today. Because it was certainly not Emerson and not Channing who ever paid attention to the institutional needs of Unitarianism. George Washington's sterling character and sense of fairness place him on this path. Peter says he provided a kind of nobility of person and exemplified a fairness and propriety that was necessary in helping a new country understand that its goal was to be a fulfillment of all that was decent and right in civilization. And you can hear this in his farewell address.
Observe good faith and justice towards all nations. Cultivate peace and harmony with all. Religion and morality enjoin this conduct, and can it be that good policy does not equally enjoin it? It will be worthy of a free, enlightened, and at no distant period, a great nation to give to mankind the magnanimous and too novel example of a people always guided by an exalted justice and benevolence. Can it be that Providence has not connected the permanent felicity of a nation with its virtue? The experiment, at least, is recommended by every sentiment which ennobles human nature.
Moses is the religious exemplar of this path, Moses the lawgiver. Typical of someone on a path of works person, Moses, even knowing he would never reach the promised land, found deep satisfaction in his lifelong commitment to working to get there, knowing that one day in the generations to follow, they would reap the reward of his efforts because he had done his duty. The fourth and final path, located in the southern hemisphere of the circle, is the path of devotion. It represents almost 40% of the general population. Spiritually, this is a path that seeks to experience God directly. God takes a living form as a friend, lover, Lord, parent. Worship is rich in stimulation, and behavior is highly prescribed. The path of devotion is a path of piety and of service. You can hear both in the readings Tom has by St. Francis and Mohammed.
From the Quran. Did he not find thee an orphan and give thee shelter and care? And he found thee wandering, and he gave thee guidance. And he found thee in need, and made thee independent. From St. Francis of Assisi. The Lord granted me, my brother Francis, grace to begin to do penance. For while I was living in sin, it seemed a very bitter thing to look at lepers. But then the Lord himself led me among them and showed pity on them. And I left them. The thing that had seemed so horrible to me was transformed into happiness of body and soul for me. After this, I delayed a while and then renounced the world.
As you might guess, Sister Teresa is also on this path. It is a path in which there is not a great deal of room for exchange of ideas or challenge or religious exploration, because it's a hands-on path of service, devotion, and celebration. And it's typically marked with festivals and processions and pilgrimages. The great religious leader who exemplifies this path is Muhammad, because the word Islam itself means surrender, and Islam asks for complete and total surrender to God. Peter does not cite any famous UUs who are representative of this path. We tend to be distributed among the other three with, as I said earlier, the majority of us on the path of unity in the north and the path of harmony in the east. These four directions tell us that we need one another, and they provide insights into our own personal spiritual leanings and sensibilities. It doesn't take much imagination to understand why in the beloved community of churches or temples, we are sometimes at odds with one another over what is most important, over how resources should be spent, over what feels appropriate or not appropriate for worship. Even this cursory description of the four different spiritual paths, I think, is helpful in understanding how congregations are most successful if they can intentionally integrate all four paths. How would a community that had no celebratory worship or no sense of devotion ever touch our souls? On the other hand, how would a community that was all poetry and mysticism ever balance its budget or plan a capital campaign? And how would a community that had no intellectual curiosity make sense of a world so filled with paradox? It is good to know who we are religiously, and it's good to know who and where our neighbors are on the circle. The circle is key. We're all on it or in it somewhere. One place on the circle is not better than any other place. We are each part of the whole, and we each contribute in our own way. And in conclusion, what better way to end a sermon on spiritual differences than with the well-known universalist poet Edward Markham, who wrote, "He drew a circle that shut me out, heretic, rebel, a thing to flout. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a circle that took him in." So may it be, and may love ever have the last word. Amen.